Versus Universe.
Good evening. Welcome to Paranexus Universe for Wednesday, May 25th, 2011. My name is Doug Kelly. I'm here with Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, Doug. Welcome, everybody, and happy Veterans Day to all you guys out there that serve, maybe serving. Appreciate your service as one vet to anybody else who served. Thanks for your service. Let's not forget about the guys who served and didn't make it back home.
Yes, let's not. We do appreciate that. And, of course, tonight on the show, we also have Brian Parsons joining us. Brian, welcome. That's your cue.
Good evening, Doug, Grant.
Earth to Brian.
I don't know. I'm having some issues here.
That's fine. If you duck out, we'll understand.
We attribute any kind of problems with Skype to something paranormal.
Actually, we have tornado warnings, and our siren just went off like 10 minutes ago. But I'm still here. So.
Well, what dedication. Tornado's coming. He stays.
This is important stuff.
All right. So we've been doing a lot of things, too, before the show here to get ready for the webcast test that I talked about on the website. So we invite those of you who can to stay with us. Well, and this is something I hadn't discussed yet with Grant or Brian prior because we were doing too many things, but we'll probably end the show a few minutes early tonight so that we can set up for the webcast a few minutes later. So if that doesn't break either of your hearts, then we'll do that.
I don't know. Okay. All right.
All right, and we'll give you more information about the webcast that we're going to do, the location to go to. If you're a Paranexus member, you received an email, so check that. There's a link there, and we'll post it in the chat room here and go from there. Also, we'd like to welcome the listeners from the Inception Radio Network, as well as Jamie Havikin, who's going to be here on the call with us. Welcome, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.
So he'll be chiming in here and there, and I'll be monitoring the Inception Radio Network chat room as best I can through the show as well. Okay, if you have questions, hit the chat room, or if you want to call in, you can. The number's on your screen. Jamie will be screening your calls. And tonight, it's just kind of an informal panel discussion on the current state of and the future of the paranormal field, and we're going to discuss things related to that. So it's just going to be an informal discussion, and we welcome your input as well. So let's, Brian, let's start with you if we could.
Sure.
What's your opinion, the current state of the paranormal research field?
Well, how many words do I get to describe the current state?
You have 50 minutes. Go.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of positives and negatives. And if I had to give kind of a grade, I would say a C minus to the amateur aspect of the field. Lots of issues. I mean, I have a whole list, and I could ramble on for more than 50 minutes about the issues and problems. But I think the biggest thing is, and I think it's part of our thing to discuss, is the lack of education. Mm-hmm. And knowledge in science, and you know, excuse me, it's sad that everyone says that they're doing science or we're a scientific group, but there's no science involved in what they're doing. You know, having fancy equipment that costs you hundreds of dollars and camera equipment, and you know, using terminology and acronyms, that's not science. You know, science isn't an event where you go in and you turn lights off and you walk around in the dark with flashlights. Science is a process. It's about controls, and it's about baseline, real baseline readings. And I don't want to say baseline readings because a lot of people say, well, we do baseline readings. We walk into a room and we walk around for 5 seconds and we know what's going on. Well, it takes more than 5 seconds to honestly determine the baseline reading to to determine what is a normal rating in a room. And again, I could go on and on about that.
Yeah, and it could require multiple ratings. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And you know, I think you're absolutely right about this, Brian, because people don't even know how to structure an experiment, let alone how to approach. And I think it's absolutely critical, you know, although most people, I think you learn how to do what the basic components of an experiment are in like eighth grade. But I think it's easy to forget, and that's the key component that you should never lose sight of when you're doing any kind of investigation.
And I think we went a whole 5 minutes without saying it, but I'm going to say it. I think the biggest issue is what I call MSMD, and that's called monkey see, monkey do. We went 5 minutes without talking about it, but I think since 2004, television has really ruined the direction of this field because it's given people a false sense of direction and a false sense of knowledge on how to do things and how to conduct an investigation or a ghost hunt. I think the TV shows have jammed the thrill-seeking ghost hunter aspect and blown that up as the focus and disguised it with fancy cameras and fancy terminology, and I think they've thrown that folklore at us, and we're looking at that as, well, this is how we're supposed to do it, and everyone follows blindly. And I don't want to blame the TV shows completely for that, because I think the internet, you know, people say, well, the TV shows helped the boom, and I say BS. I think the internet was the biggest parent of perpetuating ghost investigation and getting people together. Is the online thing. And a lot of the things that people use on their websites, if you look, everyone does the same thing. You know, the moon phase and the X-rays and all that stuff. Everybody copies everybody else, but do they really know where that came from? Has anyone really ever done any work with whether or not solar X-rays really have any true effect on ghost sightings or ghost investigations? And the full moon thing, I mean, that's the easiest one right there. Who's done any work with that?
I've heard of some work done, and they actually told me that more activity was present in their research when there was a new moon, not a full moon. But no, you know, no corroboration or no backup to it.
And I know they did it in the hospitals, you know, because people always used to say, well, the admission rates go up with a full moon, but they never got anything conclusive or anything that was statistically significant.
Yeah, there's a lot of reports on lunacy, and more often than not that it's not, you know, it's if it has been proven, a lot of it can be untangled due to experiment or bias, you know, looking for a particular answer and getting it out of the statistics that you have to work with.
But, you know, it's such an intricate part of folklore and the culture, and people have to learn how to overlook that. And I think a lot of times they don't. They just completely forget about that kind of stuff.
Right. I mean, here's another good example. Dead time. How many times have you heard that on TV?
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
People actually buy into that and believe that without any kind of scientific fact, without any kind of validation. There's no work to it. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't believe in these things. I mean, I have the full moon thing on my website. I'm not going to say I didn't fall for it, but I wondered about that. I did a lot of research into it. I read a lot of work outside of paranormal things about the study of the moon's effects on the living or people or police, you know, reports or hospital admissions. I did all that work, and I still take, even to this day, the full moon or the moon phase. I record that every time I am in a client interview and they give me dates and times. I'll look at that. I'll you know, cross-reference that information. I mean, maybe there is a connection, but so far I've not seen it. But I have the work to prove it. If anybody ever wants to come after me and say, well, you can say that all you want, but where's your evidence? Let me know. I got about 30, 40 pages worth of evidence that I have that totally blows that out of the water. It says it's not true. But then again, that's just my work.
Well, let's take a question from the Inception Radio Network chat room, which is a good question, and it bears on something you'd mentioned earlier, Brian, but it needs to be clarified. And the question is, if books, blogs, and television isn't the right way to go, then what is a better exchange of info?
No, I never said anything about books.
Right.
And I never said anything about blogs. Blogging is a good way of exchanging ideas. unfortunately, the way social media has come, I mean, I'm old school. I'm used to doing chat networks. I was on Cleveland Freenet, which I'm sure no one's even heard of. That was free internet about 15 years ago. I had an email address probably about 16, 17 years ago. So I'm old school. I'm used to chat. I'm used to, you know, instant thing and instant response, you know, dealing with a conversation. The way social media is, people hide behind their phones, they hide behind their computers, and they type stuff, and then they wait, and they wait, and they wait. And, you know, then the response comes an hour later or 5 minutes later. There's no real instant talking going on the internet anymore. So I think that's lost a little personality. And as far as books are concerned, I mean, books, there is so much information in books, it's ridiculous. And I wish more people picked up books and read books. And I'm not talking about the true ghost stories or even a lot of the Hans Holzer stuff. I mean, Hans is great, but a lot of his stuff, it just seems like stories. And not just about ghost books, because if you read a psychic, any kind of psychic book, they all have their own individual way of doing it. It's the same thing with ghost books. If you pick up a book called How to Hunt Ghosts, you're going to find one way to do it. If you pick up another book by, let's say, Lloyd Auerbach, you're going to get a different way of how to approach things. And that's great. You should learn different ways to approach it. But I think a lot of ghost investigators forget to pick up books dealing with counseling, dealing with body language, dealing with psychological factors, you know, psychology in general, you know, even statistics, something that I think everyone should pick up a book and learn how to understand, because that's science, folks, numbers.
And let me just add to that, there's nothing wrong with the internet in terms of exchanging information. It's perhaps the greatest method of exchanging information we've seen so far. It's more like everyday life. You know, we meet people in everyday life, some people we identify with, some people we don't, some people we believe, some people we don't believe. And I think what Brian was trying to get across earlier was that the internet's still good to use. It's just that you have to think for yourself. You have to question things. And especially when it comes to television, that is a completely different purpose. It is an entertainment purpose. It is not designed to teach people how to do this work. It's for entertainment, short and simple. So
yeah, I agree, Doug, completely.
The internet's great for exchanging information. Just think about why you're doing things. That's the admonition here. You know, if you've got the full moon phase, cool. We do in the research assistant on Paranexus. You know, if you've got the different things, and it's fine to take that information to note it down, like Brian was talking about, because there could be a connection. We don't know. That's part of research. So it's no problem.
And you know, the other thing that's important not to lose sight of is we're not denigrating anybody in particular. I mean, we're just throwing this out and so that it's like best practices if you're really serious about doing this. You know, that way is going to prepare you so that if you decide that, say, for instance, you find something that's significant, you'd certainly want to document it properly, and you'd want to make sure that you followed all those rules, and you know, all that would help. So, you know, it's not about, you know, that we've found the pinnacle of knowledge, because we haven't. You know, we just find that people we associate with who take this viewpoint are going to be more credible once we find something and we share information so that each of us can benefit from it. That's the whole purpose of Paranexus.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a couple of questions, one in each of the two chat rooms, that are essentially the same thing. I'm going to read them both, and then I'm going to comment and then let you guys comment. In the Inception Radio Network from Richard, question, don't you have to first show that ghosts exist before studying the effects of the moon? And in the BTR chat room from Tiger, got to find it here, scroll up, do you have to believe in ghosts to hunt for them? Those questions...
good questions.
Yeah, they are.
Let me say this real quick. In order to have proof, you first have to have evidence.
Amen.
There's my philosophical moment of the day.
But my take on this is, if you're going to look for ghosts specifically, then, yeah, I suppose you'd have to believe that they could exist. you know, you don't necessarily have to have evidence yet, but if you believe that they might exist, you could go for that purpose. A better purpose to go for is not to, quote, look for ghosts, unquote. A better purpose is to go see what's going on. People are reporting paranormal phenomena. Usually it's not paranormal phenomena, but you go there to see what's happening, and then you go where the evidence takes you. So,
and that goes back to what Brian was saying, how it's really critical. I mean, you don't need a ton of degrees to be intuitive about people, okay? Well, most of us all have that. You know, if you bump into somebody that you find, you know, like, gosh, you just don't get along, or maybe you find that you have a real affinity with, you know, it's just one of those things where I lost track of what I was going to say. Sorry, guys.
That's fine.
Because I'm getting old, so it'll come back to me in a minute. Sorry, audience.
Well, let me ask this question also from the Inception Radio Network chat room from Lorraine. Many ghost hunters say that ghosts respond to questions asked in any language. I have not found this so far. In fact, I get more response when I use the language of the area. What has been your experience?
Well, my personal experience, I speak a little bit of Spanish, I speak a little bit of French, but not enough to really ask questions. So I've never asked a question in another language. Have I heard EVPs in different languages? Yes, but, you know, it's, even after trying to, I mean, if you hear typical EVPs, they're up to interpretation anyway, for the most part. I mean, to hear a very solid, clear EVP is very, very rare, no matter how many what people seem to think. They think they get it every time they go out. But I've not been able to interpret anything as a direct answer. It more or less was haunting stuff. I've heard that people have had this happen, but, you know, it's their word. So I don't know what kind of validity that has. And, you know, if we could put that kind of piece of the puzzle together, we could figure out how that connection piece is going. If it is true ESP, it's true receptive psychic, we're actually picking things up from the environment through this equipment, or if it's going through us as channelers into our equipment, or if it's psychokinetic, we're actually thinking of things, we're asking particular questions, and we're actually imprinting our own answers into our equipment.
Yeah, and just to kind of jump back, digress, guys, I remember my train of thought now. I looked all over the room, and I finally found it. But you know, basically what I was trying to impart to folks was that, you know, you don't have to have a lot of degrees or anything else. Just be intuitive. Watch the person's behavior. Watch what goes on. Watch the dynamics between interaction between behaviors when you're doing an investigation. That will give you a lot of clues, and you know, not only you, but your team members should all be aware, and then, you know, kind of compare and contrast.
And I'll just weigh in on the language thing, too. Obviously, on one hand, it makes sense that you would use the language of the area where you're at, but I've never researched it either. I've heard other languages, but don't have much to offer in that way. There is another question, though, about what do we think of the whole waking up at 3 a.m. thing.
I don't know what that means.
Well, a lot of people have...
Spirits are most active between 3 o'clock and 5
awake.
O'clock in the morning.
Well, people will awaken at 3 a.m.
I mean, this flies in the face of conventional wisdom about spirits and apparitions and ghosts. They don't understand time. Time to them is different than our time. So how could they interact with us at 3 o'clock in the morning? And do they adjust their watches, you know, in the spring and the fall? Where they don't have daylight savings time, do they not take that into consideration?
In the afterlife, they do.
They have to wind their watches?
They have two lunches and two Saturdays and two Sundays as well.
I mean, there's a lot more questions than answers. And to believe in these silly folkloric things, I mean, if you really want to know the answer as to why you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, read about sleep cycles. And I'm not talking about dream books. I'm talking about real science, real sleep books. And you'll learn a lot about the sleep cycles, what happens to your brain at certain times. A lot of people wake up at certain times of the night. And it's just because that's the way their rhythms, their cyclical rhythms in their sleep patterns work.
Yeah, and people can't lose sight of the fact that we're still biological creatures, and, you know, we're not night creatures, you know, we're diurnal or whatever it is, if I can remember. Is that right?
Diurnal? Yes.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so, you know, hey, the body's going through biological changes when you sleep. It's going through biological changes all the time, so who's to say?
All right, here's another question. When are ghosts best photographed, in the evening or in the daytime?
That's a trick question. Because if you want to ask me honestly, I think the question should be, can ghosts be photographed? And my honest answer would be no.
Mm-hmm.
Ghosts aren't, and the biggest thing that people tend to trip over is when we talk about an apparition or we talk about a ghost, one of the definitions, and there's a million of them, of apparition is what is seen, heard, and felt or smelled that is related to the former living consciousness of a person. So these are things related to what a person was when they were alive. When we see a physical appearance of a ghost isn't physically there. That's why we can't physically measure them. If an apparition was real, we would have proven that at least 100 years ago. We would have had the evidence, the physical evidence. There would be tools that could measure it. And EMF detectors, sorry folks, don't measure ghosts. They measure
electromagnetic fields.
Exactly, which are man-made, not human-made.
Well, and natural ones. The DC ones are natural, but all right. So
but you can't, you know, it's not a physical thing. You know, when you hear footsteps, it's basically a connection to the environment. Your mind is connected to the environment in a different way. It's not something physical. So really, to say you could photograph a ghost.
Well, we don't have any proof of that, and that's the point.
Right.
Go ahead, Brian.
And if we, you know, if we just to dive into the question, I don't think it would matter. And
yeah,
you know, daylight or nighttime. I think any time is the right time, especially if you've had experiences at a certain time of day or night, that would be the best time to have those types of experiences.
And it's, you know, we've talked about this on this show a number of times, but in my opinion, you know, honestly, photographs are meaningless anyway because they don't tell us much. You know, same with video. Could there be an exception to that rule? Sure. But generally speaking, you know, photographs are too easy to fake. They just don't show anything. Okay, so you get a genuine apparition on a picture, and it's real. Great, you have a really cool picture, but what does it really tell us about our research? To me, it doesn't mean anything to speak of. Another question, can EMF affect people's perception? The answer is yes. ELFs or extra low frequencies, extremely low frequencies in the 0 to 30 hertz range can and have been scientifically shown to affect people's perception. They can give that feeling of being watched, of uncomfortable. Anything to add?
Yeah, get panicky.
Yeah, the feeling of being watched, different things. And there's still a camp of thought that says that none of that's true. But, you know, I don't know. I'll be honest, I've been in a lot of cases, and it's the only reason why I ever pull out my EMF detector. If people mention to me certain characteristics, the feeling of being watched, different, you know, the hair on the back of their neck going up, you know, just different kind of things, waking up in the middle of the night and having nightmares that they've never had nightmares, all of a sudden now they're having certain things. You know, we'll sweep the room, any area that they've had these things in, and if we find high EMF, well, it's part of the whole process. You know, it's not going to solve everything, and it might even be psychosomatic, but if we tell them, look, you know, move the fish tank away from your child's bed or move the alarm clock away from your bed and just see what happens. It's surprising how many times that alone can ease the situation that's going on.
Yeah. I'm not even sure I want to bring this one up, but...
Orbs?
Yeah.
Fire away.
Brian, go for it, man. Save me.
Well, what's the question? Is there a question about orbs?
Aren't orbs spirits? They're photographed.
Well, I guess there's a lot of spirits, you know, and no matter how much you vacuum your house, there's always going to be more spirits. You know, as we teach here at Paranexus, I don't know if we put a number on it, but I hate percentages, but it's got to be a high 99 percentile that orbs are nothing more than close proximity contamination, which in the fancy term is more or less dust, debris, or other objects that are photographed that are well within the focal range of a camera. It causes a reflection back into the screen. That's why it looks blurry, and that's why it looks see-through. And that's why it looks round, is because that's the shape of your camera lens.
Yeah.
And, unless you get a lot of different things going on at the same time, if you hear all your cabinets open and an apparition jumps out and says, hey, I'm going to appear to you as a small glowing orb in your photograph, take a picture of me now, and you take a picture and you see an orb, hallelujah, there you go. But so far I've not heard about that happening.
Well, let me tell you my take on orbs. I would love to believe that some of these orbs are spirits. I truly would. I would really like to. That would be so cool. The problem with orbs on photographs is that they can be explained beyond a reasonable doubt by airborne contaminants, dust, moisture, different things of that nature. They can be explained beyond a reasonable doubt. And some people say, well, yeah, I did. I said, please let me take a picture of you, and I do, and there's an orb there. And my response is, yeah, but you can't ever say that was not coincidentally a piece of dust, you know, in that area reflecting that light. It just, I mean, we've looked at this every way we can, and there are many orb believers. That's fine, but the problem with orbs is if you believe in them, it takes faith, and we're more in the business of you know, the scientific approach, more of an objective approach, granted, but, you know, and again, it goes back to my previous statement. Okay, let's say you get an orb on a picture, and it is a genuine spirit. What does that really tell us? It doesn't tell us much. The spirit's there? Well, according to many a psychic, spirits are all around us. We just maybe can't see them or sense them. So it doesn't really tell us anything, and that's the issue with orbs. And with that, I would like to talk about something that I've been thinking about recently, and it's about evidence. It's about paranormal evidence. Obviously, everything in this field is what is known as unfalsifiable. That means it cannot be proven true, and it cannot be proven false. It's unfalsifiable. In science, when they're conducting experiments, they try to falsify it. That means they try to prove it untrue. If it remains true, then they've got something. But in this field, it's everything we do is unfalsifiable. So we have to use some other type of system, you know, to get some kind of indications for us to walk down some path, right? To string along a hypothesis or to develop a hypothesis. And so, you know, I was talking with my wife Tracy about this last night, and she, you know, was talking about the logical sustainable conclusion, and I modified that to a logical defensible conclusion. And so what I'm going to offer, and I'm still developing this, is a level of evidence that's not absolute proof, but when you have compelling evidence that suggests something, even though you can't objectively prove it, that does still mean something, especially in a field where you can't hardly prove anything. And so I'm really developing this logical, defensible conclusion as a type of evidence that's still compelling. You know, I mean, there's got to be some basis for it, but it's obviously not provable. Comments?
Well, I think that, a lot of people that do anthropological work come to the same conclusion sometimes. You know, when you're talking about cultural beliefs or ingrained beliefs of people and the cultures and the communities they live in, sometimes, you know, you're not going to get all those hardcore answers, you know. But by the same token, you know, I mean, you can do case studies and cultural studies, and it all fits into the belief system. So if you come across something that's, you know, that's really, you know, along the lines that you're talking about, Doug, I mean, yeah.
I mean, think about it. When we're
do
sitting in front
study.
Of a table.
Yeah, yeah.
When we're sitting in front of a table, Grant, and the thing's moving seemingly of its own volition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't know objectively whether that's collective energy from us, whether it's spirits moving it. We really don't know what the source is. But one thing that we can't deny is that the table's moving.
Yep.
And so we have, you know, this logically defensible conclusion. We have some evidence. We don't quite know what it means yet, where it's coming from, but we got something. And,
yeah.
And there
are absolutely, because it's for everybody to build on. I think that's what people have to see, is that it doesn't really matter. I mean, it does matter in the sense that it's say if you're doing even, you know, any kind of research, and that you work at a different angle at it, approach from a different angle, you're making a contribution, whether it turns out right or wrong. You're trying to make a contribution to the field.
Right.
And you can easily do that. And it doesn't have to be, you know, like a, you know, parametric statistics. It can be, you know, a case study, you know, and that's what good investigation is going to, you know, is going to require.
Well, here's
for any validity.
Here's a related question. Have any of you had a personal experience that you could not prove or disprove, but something that really stuck with you? And the answer is yes. I mean, I have, and I'm pretty sure, I know Grant has, pretty sure Brian has, but,
yep.
You know, we've had these experiences that are subjective, that call them subjective experiences, and they can happen to several of us. I've been there when things have happened, the water faucets turned on, the TVs have turned on, nobody did it. You know, we've looked at what could have caused this. Well, we don't know what the source is, but, you know, it did happen. And so that's what I'm talking about. When we have compelling evidence, especially corroborated by other witnesses that are credible, we've got something. We don't have absolute proof, but we've got something which I am terming logically defensible conclusion. Something happened, and it's in lieu of absolute proof. Let's talk a little bit, too. We kind of started off with the state of the paranormal field, and this led into this, which is still a good discussion. And, Brian, you'd commented on that. And I have to agree that the biggest problem that I see with parts, not all, but parts of the paranormal research field, and when I say that, and I probably should say anomalous research field, because I'm talking about everything, whether it's ufology, parapsychology, hauntings, you name it. The biggest thing I see, biggest issue, is a lack of education. And that specifically in the ghost hunting part of the paranormal research field. And that's one thing that I want to encourage, like Brian did, for people to really take a serious attitude toward education. Learn about these things and think for yourself. Don't just copycat. Don't just do it because some other group's doing it or because you saw it on TV. But look, learn, read. You know, I've taken an awful lot of crap over the last 4 years for my CPI course. I mean, a lot of it. It's been the subject of radio programs. I've gotten hate mail, you know, and I just have to laugh. I mean, I've already written my responses. It's on Paranexus.
Laughing all the way to the bank, aren't you, Doug Kelly?
Oh, man. Am I rich or what? Jeepers. I just purchased my second jet.
Yep.
Anyway, that's
and
all.
He doesn't give us a ride in it either.
And so if you want to know the responses and my basis for the validity of paranormal courses, go to paranexus.org, check the blogs, check Doug Kelly's blog, and you'll find it. There's two blog posts there. But the point is that it's the uneducated who gripe about it. It's the people who think and automatically assume the worst in others who gripe about it. And because of what they've been told by the TV people and the prominent ones in the field who, in my opinion, and very directly, have not done people a good service by telling them and spreading these myths like there are no experts in this field. That's baloney. There are experts in this field. Whether they deserve to be experts or not, they're still looked at as experts. And that means they have a responsibility to do people right and to steer them right. And that means education.
But, you know, the real interesting thing is, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brian, but I'm jumping back real quick. The one thing that I find really interesting is ever since we've evolved in all good groups, this is what I know Doug shares this with me, but I really believe, and I'm sure Brian does too, that you won't be a good investigation group unless you're continually evolving. And what I found, just my own personal observation, is the more we evolved and changed our approach to how we did investigations, the less calls we got.
Yeah.
And it just seems that way now that, you know, years ago where we go out on a call and you know, maybe we've got a little bit more visibility than we did now. But, I mean, I'm never – and I know that Brian and Doug feel the same way. We're not opposed to doing investigations. We haven't quit. You know, we just haven't been, you know, people haven't been coming to us. And maybe they think that we're just going to poo-poo everything, which in reality, that's not exactly the case. You know, we're into it. If you have something serious, let us know. You know, we'll be more than happy to come out and take a look.
Yeah.
But I think you really have to evolve. Sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
Oh, that's fine. You know, talking about, you know, people thinking they know everything, there's books. There's a fantastic book called The Invisible Gorilla. I don't know if anyone out there has read this. I'm sure you've seen the YouTube video where there's two teams playing basketball, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to watch the one team pass the ball and count how many times they pass, and then this gorilla walks through. And you know, it's a kind of an awareness test. And basically this book is written by two people who conducted this experiment. And they talk about illusion of awareness, but they also talk about the illusion of a lot of different things that we're not really so aware that happens to us. And one of those things is the illusion of knowledge. And I see that happening. You know, when I read this chapter, I was like, wow, this is exactly what's happening in this field. People see something on TV. They see that other groups believe the same things they believe. So they believe instantly that they know everything there is to know. And that's why they get defensive about other people teaching these things, because, well, how dare they teach that? You know, I know everything. I would never need to take that. And it's a sad reality that a lot of those people are the ones, unfortunately, that really need to be educated on certain concepts within our field and outside of our field.
Well,
and it's not so much, you know, we're saying a lack of education. And I think kind of what I mean is a lack of continuing self-education.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Different aspects, and not just about the ghost hunting field or ufology or about cryptozoology, but again, about science, about, you know, different
psychology.
Aspects of psychology and,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the knowledge of dealing, interpersonal communication, all the stuff that we deal with that we could all be a little bit better at things, you know, if we step back and evaluate ourselves every once in a while and go, you know, that interview didn't go so good. Maybe I could work on my communication, or, you know, what did I do wrong? You know, maybe I could even ask the client, you know, how did you feel about my interview process? Did I not look you in the eye enough? Okay, good. I'll work on that next time. You know, are we working on ourselves? And that's really the bottom line with that, because if all your investigations are the same, you get the same kind of evidence and the same kind of things happen, and that keeps you happy, fine. But if you don't notice that you're getting lesser results because you're being more critical, or your evidence is getting better, you're critiquing your skills more. If you're not going, you know, higher, you're not going anywhere.
Well, I've always maintained that the very first place you start in learning to be a paranormal researcher is with you, with oneself. And that is the very basis of the CPI course, learning to know yourself, to accept yourself, intercommunication skills, relationship skills, people skills, and then you learn the stuff about investigations and how to do it and all that. It's all the first place you start is with oneself, and that's education in all those areas that Brian has talked about. So, you know, if you're part of that, if you've been duped by those statements that there are no experts in the field or that nobody can certify you, that is absolute shallow thinking. It is wrong. And I will admit, I used to be of that opinion. So I was there once too. It's shallow. I mean, I could say, who knows everything about physics? And yet there are doctors who are physicists, and they are considered experts, and they have to go to school a long, long time to learn this stuff just to be able to research it. The same is true in paranormal research. You have to learn at least a certain amount in order to carry that forward. So education is paramount. So the current state of the paranormal field depends on which part of it. I think ufology has always been ahead of the haunting aspect in many ways. I think it's looked at as more credible. That's why you see more academics involved in it. And we...
Well, I think, Doug, you know, I think that despite all of the difficulties that we've seen and we pointed out, I'm a little bit more optimistic, and I'm not saying you aren't optimistic. I'm optimistic because I think that what's going to happen is, as time goes on, what's going to happen is the people who are in it are just going to burn off, who aren't really serious about it. I mean, look at how many people we've seen come and go. And we're here for the duration, you know. We're here because we're all mutually interested in this stuff, and you know, we're not getting anything for it except, you know, our own self-enrichment, you know. So, but what I'm optimistic about is I think that is the core kind of, as it burns off to the core, then, you know, and people have the same approach, and we start sharing information with all the new stuff that's going on in physics. You know, although we may never pinpoint, you know, exactly what's going on, it may be the interaction between different things, you know, that we can't see. And, you know, we can't rule that out. And so it may get exciting, and there may be ways, even though right now we're in a very elementary stage of understanding all that stuff, maybe there's some ways that somewhere down the line, you know, things will be more definitive.
But I'm optimistic, too. It's just that the current state, in one part of it, is really, like Brian said, C minus?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
you're good.
Absolutely. I'm in total agreement with that. But I also think that, you know what, those shows kind of die out after a while. You know, they have a running life, and then they kind of go kaput. Because how many demons can you have? How many, you know, cases, you know, where there's a haunting going on, nothing's definitive, and pretty soon after a while, people just go like, what the hell did they find? They didn't find nothing. It's all their perceptions,
mm-hmm.
and right. how they read the perceptions of the people who inhabit whatever dwelling they're in.
All right, real quick, there was a comment by Richard in the Inception Radio Network chat about best cases that convince in the haunting field. There are, of course, many in the UFO field. Any that you know of, Brian?
As far as what that's...
best cases for hauntings,
proven.
Yeah, that really, you know, seem to offer some compelling evidence for the existence of ghosts.
Nothing really. I mean,
I can't think of anything.
If there was something out there, then...
If you read some of Hans Holzer's stuff, that was pretty amazing to me because he was using, he always used a trance medium, and they were able to validate some of the stuff that came out of that. So that was pretty compelling. Not every one of his stories is like that, but there were several. So you might check that. And I'm just trying to get to a couple of these questions, and then I want to address the future of the paranormal field. How do you balance people's privacy, names, address against credibility that is gathering cases that you'd like to publish? And I'm going to quickly answer that. You have to maintain privacy. You cannot use anything that would personally identify that client unless they have signed off on it. They've released that. That's why you need to have a release clause or a release agreement.
Yeah, that's called ethics.
Yeah.
And that's something that's absolutely critical if you're serious about doing this.
But the thing about that is one case will not make proof. You're not going to have one investigation that's going to prove the existence of ghosts. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's going to take several dozen clients, if not hundreds of clients, looking at these, you know, just as you said a couple minutes ago, Grant, about case studies. That's continuously what I'm doing. I'm looking
mm-hmm.
at cross-referencing different kinds of information, looking for a line that I can see, hey, you know, this has some validation. That's when you take that work and you publish it. You publish it anywhere you can for peer
mm-hmm.
review. That's for other people to take your work, critique it, try to prove it right, try to prove it wrong, do whatever. And that is what science is. That's what scientists do. They get all their work together. They have their references all together. And I'm not saying, again, you know, private client information, just your work. And you put it out there to the world, and you let them critique it. And it's not like doing a, you know, your case investigation thing on your website where, oh, Joe Dottie and I walked into the house at 4 o'clock and we saw plates flying through the window. I mean, that's it's all anecdotal. This is, you know, your science, your work, your statistics,
yep.
your science, your...
Yep, and
your,
it's also,
you know,
about developing a thick skin and a professional a demeanor when people are critical of your work. And you know what? That comes with the territory. And rather than take it in as an offense, take it as a way that that you can become better. Because otherwise, right, because otherwise, you know, if you take offense, then communication, you know, breaks down. And so the thing of it is be open. And one of the only reason why I bring that up is it seems like so many people who have thought that they had cornered the market on, you know, whether it was an orb or a ghost photo or something else, you know, just, you know, went the opposite direction on us when we, you know, questioned. Like, how dare we question? When in reality, that's the essence, because you got to put whatever you got up for everybody to take a shot at it, and they get
right.
feedback.
And, you know, and I've been doing this since doing this was cool. You know, I've been doing this since 1996. So, I mean, that's not ancient history, but again, when I started out, I didn't tell a lot of people I did this because it wasn't cool to do this. And I got a lot of flack when certain people found out about it, or I went to do some public speaking and people were like, Are you completely serious? You actually do this stuff? What the hell is wrong with you? You know, and I had a lot of attacks, and you really have to think through all these things. And sometimes it's great because it does help you balance things out and think a little bit more skeptically, which is skepticism is something that we'll talk about in our next phase here with the future.
All right, so let's take another quick question, and then let's go on to the future of paranormal research. From Sarah in the IRN chat, what if someone refuses to acknowledge your evidence no matter how much you show them? What about debunkers?
Well, I've been on the other side of that. I've seen a lot of different things. I think I shared the bathroom ghost story that was on Paranexus on the forum about definitive proof that it was a digital recorder in this particular person's video, and this guy totally he blew up at me and said, you know, you're reaching, that's not even going to answer half my question. So I mean, I've been on that side of the fence, but I'll be honest, I really never put anything out there and said, look everybody, this is a ghost, because I know better. And if I do go and do that, I expect full well to get attacked. I've asked other people, hey, look at this and tell me what you think, you know. Maybe it's my approach, because I don't put out YouTube videos with, you know, my scary ghost adventure or a real ghost video, and, you know, it's a 2-minute clip of us tumbling around in the dark. And, you know, I don't do that. I'm not going to set myself up for that kind of thing, because that to me just it reeks of, and I hate to use the word amateurism, even though being an amateur isn't a bad thing, but just an amateur in general, like you just don't really know how.
Yeah, a misinformed amateur.
You know,
yeah.
You know, this isn't TV. This is, you know, if you have a group and you're doing these things, wake up, this is real life, this isn't television, you know, treat it with some respect. I don't really put myself out there. I mean, I've put some pictures out there and said, hey, you know, what do you guys think? And over the years, I've learned how to problem solve. I've learned how to recognize issues in photographs. I mean, hey, I've become an expert, I want to say. I'll brag about it. I think I've become pretty good at looking at photographs and being able to find a logical conclusion, or at least know when to raise that white flag of say, hey, I don't know, you know, but I'm not going to jump to a paranormal conclusion just because I raise a white flag.
With that being said, though, Brian, just for the heck of it, how many have you said, or what would you say in the percentage have been ones that have intrigued you that have been on the borderline?
Percentages. Here we go with percentages again.
Well, what the heck, you know?
I don't know. I mean, it's, I'll be honest, over time, it's gotten smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's because I'm getting smarter or because of the technology. Again, I started out in 96. We had these cameras where we had to put this, like, cartridge of film in it. Imagine that.
What's that?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, you'd have to go to the Smithsonian.
It's, you know, like you got to have magnesium, you know, to get a good flash.
So it's...
All right.
So technology has changed, but unfortunately... And I'll talk about it at our webinar afterwards about how technology has come against us.
A couple of last questions that I'm going to address real quickly, and then we have to get to the future part because we're going to do this webcast in a few minutes too. Kathy wants to know, is it acceptable to approach someone who lives in a house that you believe is worth investigating and ask them without waiting for them to approach you? In other words, is it okay to go ask somebody to investigate their house?
Well, how would you know that there's reason to investigate it? I mean, maybe there, you've read about a brutal murder there or something. I think that's a touchy situation. I think it would have to relate to what happened at the location. If it's a historical site and somebody's living there, you may have a little bit more credence than if you know, there was a murder there 5 years ago.
Yeah, if it's
even then, I think it's just how you approach it. You know, if you say you show up with five people with black shirts on with ghost logos and the ghost screaming on the front of the shirt.
All right, Kathy said she used to live in it. Okay, so you might have a foot in the door.
Exactly.
But just to go to somebody's house and say, hey, can we come and investigate? I mean,
cool.
You got to put yourself in their shoes,
want to get their address and send them a letter first.
Yeah.
I mean, Catherine's particular case, what I would do is, just knock on the door and say, hey, I used to live here. I just wanted to look at the house. Do you mind if I walk around outside or inside or whatever, just to look at it? And, then you leave it on the table, say, how have things been since you've been here? You don't want to bring up, hey, when I was here, there was all kinds of stuff flying off the shelves or,
yeah,
this
really?
Or that.
Yeah.
You don't want to install fear, and then you don't want them thinking you're completely nuts.
Yeah, or telling them it was haunted when you lived there. So.
And the headless woman still in the bedroom.
Well, what I mean by that is it's kind of twofold. One, you don't want them thinking you're crazy, and two, you don't want to give them preconceived notions about something in the house. They might not have ever experienced anything there for 10 or 15 years.
And you open your mouth, and then there's all kinds of trouble.
Right, then they think, well, maybe there is, I do remember hearing a knock. Maybe that was a ghost. And then the next thing you know, they're in dire need of help because, that process has started with their belief system and everything.
All right, we've got to get on to future of the paranormal field, and we've got to keep it a little bit brief. So, Brian, you want to share with us what you think?
Well, the future, I think, and I'm going to get T-shirts made with this, and I'll put Paranexus logo on it. My new, I don't know what you call it, a mantra, I guess, is alter the culture. And that's what we need to do to grow, to move forward. If people talk about the field, and a lot of people say, well, this isn't a field. I don't know where I stand on that. I really think this is a field. It's a discipline because we're trying to establish facts around particular questions. So to me, it's a field. But in order to do that, we have to alter the culture that's been put forth ahead of us. And a lot of this is prior to the television shows and prior to the internet. There's a lot of, folklore that we have to work around. We have to, not prey on that so much, the whole dead time and the full moon thing, and put that aside. And we also have to look at science and reality. Stop jumping to conclusions, based on very little evidence or hey, I can't explain this. This must be a ghost because this is what I'm here for. We have to start looking at it a little bit more skeptically. And I'm still seeing a lot of people get defensive about skepticism. And I'll be honest, like Doug admitted something. I'll admit, something too. I used to really despise skeptics when I first started out. And I thought they were the enemy, but now I'm really understanding, again, becoming an expert in my field. I've learned that skepticism is needed. I mean, a scientist doesn't go out and say, I want to prove that butterflies can fly. A scientist is going to say, I'm going to try to prove that butterflies can't fly. So I think in order for us to prove that ghosts exist, we have to first try to prove that they don't exist or try to prove that let's find all the reasons to explain the phenomena first before we're settling in on the phenomena being there itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people get tied into the ghost, and they go out and get their black shirts with their groups printed on it, and they want to buy as many flashlights and IR cameras and pretend to do what they see on TV without really digging into the reality behind what's really going on. And the last part of my thing is the history. Look back at parapsychology. We're talking about case studies and field work. Read about that stuff. There was a lot of phenomenal stuff that was done in the late 1800s, early 1900s, 1920 to 1940 defined what we do today. All the terminology, all of our approaches, all our investigation techniques came from almost 80, 90 years ago. So the history is there. All you have to do is open up, find the book, open it up, and read it.
Cool. Grant, what do you have to say about the future of the field?
I'm optimistic. I think that, you know, like I said before, it's going to boil down to the people who are really serious about doing it and who also look at it from a pretty eclectic viewpoint and that realize, you know, how many different factors can actually be involved. And I'm just optimistic that, you know, as time goes on and the sensationalism wears off, the folks who have been at it for a while, you know, are you know, work, because I think, and we've talked about this before, Doug, is I think that we're a kind of a neat combination between, you know, psychology and anthropology, and I think that's really where we fit, where we best fit, and you know, I think there's room for growth, and I think there's room for acceptance. I think, you know, it all depends on how we're only as good as what we can collect in the field and document.
Good. All right, and I'll just add my 2 cents in about the future of the field, and I am also optimistic, but I want to warmly urge those, especially in the ghost hunting segment of the field, to look to education, and everybody in the field to continue education with themselves. Continuing education for themselves in a variety of topics, as Brian has already discussed, in psychology, in communication, in knowing yourself and accepting yourself, and on and on. I also want to urge people in different parts of the field to stop fighting, to stop competing. And there still is a lot of petty fighting going on, even petty infighting, and it is beneath us. Nobody will take us seriously if it's just about a bunch of fighting. Share information. That's what Paranexus was designed for. And I will tell you, when I founded Paranexus 3 years ago, you know, part of the deal was let's share, let's work together. No competition here, you know, no egos. Let's just find some answers and let's draw some people, some like-minded people who just want to have answers. And everybody can contribute. You know, everybody has their little breakthroughs and can be noted for coming up with something. That's great, you know, but let's find some answers. And I will admit, it has been disillusioning for me because it doesn't seem like there's that many of them out there. Now, we have, you know, our members, and we love our members, and we always invite people to come and join us and to share and to be a part of it. And, you know, so I can't encourage that enough. You know, let's forget the competition. Let's forget the fighting. Let's forget the petty rivalries. Let's come together and work together because that's our greatest strength as human beings. We can do this, and we don't need some catastrophe to bring us together, to work together. You know, that's what happens. I mean, some destruction thing happens and people come together. Well, let's do it without that. Now, we're running out of time. I got to tell you this. We're going to do a webcast test right here in about, let's say, about 10 to 15 minutes after 9 o'clock. So in about another 10 or 15 minutes, I'm going to give you the link in both chat rooms. And you can go there. All you have to do is put your name in and sign in, and we'll come on. Just hang tough there. There's a chat room there as well. We're going to do a brief little presentation Brian's going to do on Photography 101. So I hope you'll come and help us to test out this new webcast software that we have. We appreciate all your questions tonight. Next week, we're going to have Steve Coles with us, talking about the Trail Cam Bigfoot photo, which was recently released. And so hopefully you'll join us for that program. Brian, thanks for joining us tonight. It was great to have you.
Great to be here.
And Grant, as always, a pleasure.
Yeah, I like these panel discussions, and I think we need to do more of them. And, you know, feedback from the audience would help. Yeah, are these helpful?
All right. And folks, in the chat room, I put the links there. If you're a Paranexus member, it's also in your email basket. So please come join us and help us to test out this webcast software. We really appreciate it. Something new that we're going to be doing. Take care, everybody. We're out of time. Good night.